Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Quick introductions of the panel. I know you have programs. To my immediate right is Claudia Anderson. Claudia has been the managing editor of the Weekly Standard since the magazine was founded in 1995. Before that, she was for 13 years the chief editorial writer for Scripps Howard newspapers and also the editorial page editor of the Cincinnati Post. She's edited books for the American Enterprise Institute. She was a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics, and she's especially well-educated in that she holds a master's degree from Cal. To Claudia's right is Jack Pitney. Jack is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of American Politics at Claremont McKenna. He's a senior policy fellow with the Pacific Research Institute. Prior to becoming an academic, he worked for several Republican politicians, Alphonse D'Amato, among others, as a congressional fellow. He worked for the House Republican Policy Committee, which was then chaired by a House member named Dick Cheney. Later, during a leave from Claremont, he served as acting director of the Research Department of the Republican National Committee under the legendary Republican operative Lee Atwater. His books include The Art of Political Warfare and a book on the last presidential election, Epic Journey, the 2008 Elections and American Politics. Next to Jack is Anne O'Leary. Anne is the executive director of the Berkeley Center on Health Economics and Family Security, part of the Berkeley School of Law. She's also a senior fellow with the Center for American Progress. Anne worked in senior positions for both of the Clintons from 1994 to 2000. She held a number of positions in Bill Clinton's administration, including special assistant to the president on the Domestic Policy Council. From 2001 to 2003, she was legislative director for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. She was later a volunteer policy advisor to the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign and to the Obama-Biden transition team. And since I mentioned that Claudia is an alum, I should also mention that Anne is a graduate of the Berkeley Law School. And then on the far right is Dan Baltz. Dan has been a political correspondent for the Washington Post since 1978. Has held many positions at the Post, including national editor, political editor, White House correspondent. He appears frequently on television programs such as Washington Week and Meet the Press. In 1999, he received the American Political Science Association Award for political coverage. His latest book, which was co-authored with Haynes Johnson, is like Jack's most recent book on the 2008 election. Dan's book is The Battle for America, 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election. Okay, so as always, I will encourage the panelists to sort of just jump in. We like a freewheeling discussion at this event, and I'm sure that all of you will accommodate that. In doing some prep for this, I realized that it was almost exactly a year ago that the president signed his health care bill, a signal achievement of his administration. One might have thought that this might have given him a little political momentum, a major accomplishment so early in the term. Instead, he's had, it seems to me, a fairly tough year. He is a little less popular, according to the polls, than he was a year ago. He suffered a shellacking at the midterm elections by his own account. He was forced to extend the Bush tax cuts even for the wealthiest Americans. He recently backed off the health care, at least in one minor sense, of agreeing to move up the date for the state waivers. Seems to me it's been kind of a tough year. So, Dan, I'll throw it to you first and then let other people jump in. But you cover this stuff every day in Washington. What's happened to President Obama in the last year?
Well, he has had a tough year despite the fact that he got through the biggest piece of domestic legislation since the Great Society. One of the things that's been curious about the Obama presidency is, in a sense, either the lack of definition or the competing definitions of who Barack Obama is as president. If you talk to people at the White House, their view is that the problems that they have experienced, particularly the political problems in the results of the midterm election, it is almost solely a function of a terrible economy that they inherited and that we're having to deal with, and that unemployment rate was almost 10% at the time of the election, and that created an anxiety, an unrest, an unhappiness, a sourness on the part of the voters, and that they knew they were doing things that were going to cause the economy they hoped to get better, but not in the short term, and that in the short term it was going to be acts and actions that were going to cause a backlash. I think it's more complicated than that. I think that part of the problem that the president has had is that he undertook a very, very ambitious agenda, not just on the economy, but also with health care, without fully preparing the country for it. And I think that he and the people around him underappreciated the degree to which the amount of money that they were spending and, in a sense, the amount of government they were asking people to swallow in that first year and a half was going to cause a problem, and that they did not sell it effectively. When we were doing the book on 2008, we did an interview with President-elect Obama in December of just after he had been elected, and asked the question, do you think your election meant the end of the Reagan era? And by that, I meant the end of a long period of conservative ascendance. And he said, no, I don't think that's the case, because he said, I think there are certain things that Reagan did that are deeply ingrained in this country and that are still there. He said, I don't think this is a question of big government or small government. He said, I think it's a question of whether government can be smart and handling the problems that people feel need to be handled. I don't think in the first 2 years he has persuaded people that the approach he has taken is the right approach overall. And I think that in part it's because he has been tentative about some of those decisions he's had to make.
And I noticed when you were nodding when Dan said that he failed to prepare the country for that.
Yeah.
You agree with that?
Yeah, so I agree with everything Dan said. And I would just add to it, one of the things I think is so curious and interesting is that Obama really has shifted the way we think of government, or the way we should think of government, and yet we don't view it differently. And let me give one specific example. You know, in December when you were interviewing him, I had the privilege of being on the Obama transition and really looking at what was happening as the Obama team was preparing for the economic recovery package that they were about to introduce in Congress and then go ahead and pass. And this wasn't something I specifically worked on, but I looked at really carefully, was this idea that there was this deep sense of concern about the rising unemployment rate. And so in that package, there were some major changes that were made to unemployment insurance. And so what you often hear about in the media is the idea that we keep extending unemployment insurance to allow people to have greater time on unemployment insurance. But one thing you may not hear as much about is that we also have included many more people having access to unemployment insurance, because there was a package that provided incentives to states to increase the way that they provided unemployment insurance to part-time workers, the way that they calculated whether or not you were eligible for unemployment insurance. And I use this as an example because I think in some sense it's a way in which Obama could have gone out there and really explained to the country, in times like this, this is why we have a social safety net in our country, this is why we should support workers who have worked hard and have paid into unemployment insurance that their employers have. And yet he didn't do that. He never really fully explained. I think many people probably in this room don't know that those changes were made. So I think there has been a real failure of kind of communicating a vision of what the government should do in these hard economic times.
Why did he fail to do that?
Here was a
guy known for his eloquence, his rhetorical eloquence, and yet a failure of communication?
Yeah, I think it was a failure of communication, and I'm, you know, not a communication expert. I think really interestingly, he went out there and said, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to create jobs, and we're going to make sure that the unemployment rate doesn't get much, you know, it'll hover around 8%. We're going to try to get it below 8%. And, you know, frankly, we're at 9.5% last month. For the last 2 years, he's never been able to meet that. So he's made some very serious communications errors in terms of going out there and making promises that he really had little control over and couldn't keep. And then he hasn't explained what we do in the backdrop. So, you know, I'd turn to others to ask, what is this communication failure?
Well, I'm curious. Jack, we'll go to you. Claudia, do you agree is it a communication failure? Is it a policy failure? Or is it just, as Dan started off by saying, the crummy economy?
One problem, particularly with the healthcare bill, has a lot of moving parts. It is extremely complicated, perhaps not as complicated as the 1993 healthcare proposal, but very, very hard to describe in a tweet. and therefore, developing this comprehensive vision that can be persuasive people is really, really difficult.
Well, and it's not just that you can't describe it in a tweet. It's almost 3,000 pages long. And it creates an extraordinarily complex set of agencies and commissions and boards, and affects a huge portion of the economy. And this is a hard sell to the American people. They particularly coming off that clobbering of the financial crisis, the sticker shock of the TARP and then the stimulus and then the huge budget with far larger deficits than we'd ever seen before. Although there was tremendous emphasis placed on the health care reform, this was supposed to be the linchpin achievement, it was incomprehensible to citizens. And the claim that it would save money was unpersuasive. It was simply not credible.
Right. That sounds to me like you're describing not a failure of communication, but a failure of policy, that there were policies pursued which, in your view, were overreaching or unworkable or unconvincing. I think there's two separate arguments here. One, that there's some communication issue on behalf of a positive agenda. Another, that the agenda was weak or
I think he failed to sell the health bill to the public because the polls reflect its unpopularity over a long period of months, if maybe more than a year by now. And I think that's a failure of substance, particularly at a time when there was a hunger I think the Tea Party movement had this this great enthusiasm for the Constitution. The Constitution is a document that any sixth grader can read from beginning to end in an hour or less. And at the opposite extreme of a public document would be this bill that none of the legislators had read from beginning to end, that they could not explain, and that the president...
Certainly not the first time Congress has voted on a bill they hadn't read.
No, but yeah. it was an instance that really got the public spotlight because the president had... Well, it's not just that Barack Obama saw it as a paramount achievement. It had been the prize item on the liberal left agenda since Harry Truman, if not before. And that... The president told us over and over that one of the reasons we had to have it was that it would save money. And this, I don't believe he succeeded in persuading the country.
And do you agree that the money claim was an unpersuasive claim? Should he have not made that claim?
Let me first take one other point, and then I'll come back to that. But one of the points that that Claudia is making is that there is this lack of public favoritism towards the bill. And I think one of the things that you actually look at when you dig into these polls is that some people believe that the president actually didn't go far enough in terms of health reform. So it's true that there's a lot of public concern about the bill. Some people feel like you're not going to solve my health problems, and that's why I'm not supporting it. Other people feel like it's, you know, the more traditional concerns about the bill. So I think there's that issue. Then the secondary issue, I would say, before I get to cost, is that one of the things, obviously, that the Congress tried to do and that Obama tried to do is to really make some real hard pieces happen right away. So, for example, we made sure that children with pre-existing conditions would no longer be denied health insurance, and that would become effective pretty immediately after the law passed. Same thing with young people who were aging off of their parents' plans. They would get health care. And so these have begun to happen, and there's now beginning to be a political constituency who are seeing the benefits. But those are pretty small populations of people. Many, many more people are in kind of two other camps, which is that they have employer-based coverage and they're really getting worried about what's happening and they have no idea how this is going to impact them. And so they are seeing these kind of gamesmanship that's going on with premium increases and they're not sure what's going to happen with that. And so that is a really big, real issue. And then the other people are the uninsured who remain uninsured and remain unable to access it because, frankly, other than catastrophic care, we're still waiting until 2014 to set that up. So I think that because of the long ramp up, there are these real political issues. In terms of the cost containment, I think that that is an issue, and it, like the others, it's going to take time. You're not going to be able to contain these costs until you fully implement the bill. So I think that I still believe this is a communications failure. It is really complicated. You need to build a political constituency to support it, and he hasn't done that yet. Do I think it's a policy failure? I don't think it is. I'm very worried about these waivers, and I know we'll talk about those later. I do think there's some concern that we're not going to be able to implement this bill, and that would concern me more.
Should he have waited? Would you have told him to wait on health care?
No, I think he did the right thing. If you look at the political science research, is that the minute in the first, it's much more probable that you're going to pass a major domestic initiative in the first year of your presidency than if you wait. And I think that if he needed to do this, and he did need to do it, he had to do it immediately. I think the problem, and I'll be curious what Dan and others think, is that he did it at a time in which people were most concerned not about whether they had health care, but whether they had any income. They were losing their jobs. The economy is falling apart. They're seeing their jobs moved overseas, and there's not a clear vision of how we're going to have a jobs economy. And I think that is why it seemed a little tone deaf to them, even though, as Claudia said, you know, we've been ramping up for this for 20 or more years. But I think at the time, in that particular year, it wasn't the number one concern. Jobs and the economy was, and that's why there was some disconnect.
Dan, what do you think about that? Should you wait?
They clearly believe at this point that it was worth the gamble that they took. And despite the obvious political cost that they've taken in the short term, but they certainly expected that upon passage last year, they were going to get a much more significant boost than they ever got. So they certainly miscalculated the short-term politics of it. I think there are two elements to this. One is, given the state of the economy coming out of the election, should they have said, or should the president have said when he first came into office, my ambition is to provide health care to all Americans, or to make health care accessible and affordable to all Americans. But given the conditions we now face on the economy, the best I can do right now is a down payment on that. And I will pursue a down payment with the hope that we can continue to build on it through my administration. They took the opposite course, the famous Rahm Emanuel line, never let a good crisis go to waste. But I think what's interesting is there were any number of people around the president, including Rahm Emanuel and at times David Axelrod, who cautioned pull back. And it was the president at virtually every turn when that advice came to him who insisted that they were going to continue to go ahead and try to do the whole thing. What they certainly didn't anticipate, and I think what really took the toll, was the amount of time and energy that healthcare absorbed in that first year plus of the administration. I mean, their timetable when they were in the transition was to have that done by shortly after Labor Day. And instead, it dragged on and on and on. You know, we can litigate the reasons it did and whether they could or should have done things along the way to prod the process. But it took so long that, A, it did take focus off the economy. B, it put a bright light on the sausage making in Congress, which in this particular case got to be pretty ugly at times. And I think that the other problem, it's just a reminder of the political dangers of trying to enact something that big, that large, without some sense of bipartisan agreement on it. Now, you can argue that it was the Republicans who were unwilling to deal, or the White House who was unwilling to deal. We can't resolve that tonight, but there's no question that that Obama's willingness to do this strictly with Democratic votes came at a high cost.
Jack, did you want to?
Mostly related to the issue of complexity is uncertainty, because with something this big and complicated, measuring the likely effects is extremely difficult. How much is this going to cost? How many people are going to be affected in what way? There were a lot of numbers thrown around in the debate, and a lot of people just didn't believe them. In part, you alluded to this before, the initial public relations error of projecting that unemployment would top out at 8%. That was not smart. Also, it was a legacy of years and years of numbers and quote-unquote facts coming from Washington that turned out to be plain wrong. So they had to deal with that. And consequently, they were the plan was running into some radical skepticism. Even when the Obama administration thought they had had a good case, people just didn't believe it.
Is there something, having pursued the health care plan, having achieved that as a significant policy achievement, at least for those people who supported the bill, is there something substantial or significant the president could have done differently in the wake of that that would have raised his popularity over the last year, or given the economy, was he destined to lose some popularity over this last year? Because is there something that Anne, if you'd still been there instead of on the transition team, if you'd been there in the White House, would you have told him to do something differently?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is they used so much political capital on getting the health reform bill done that it was then difficult to kind of figure out how do you then go back to your jobs agenda. So there were many people in Washington on the left side who were calling for a second stimulus bill, saying that, you know, we actually didn't spend enough the first time around when we spent $867 billion on the recovery, that it should have been much larger. And if it had been larger, it would have created more jobs and we could continue. But there was no way you were going to get a second stimulus through the Congress after having just dealt with the health reform bill and used every single political capital, you know, that you had. So I think that it's hard to say what they could have done other than, you know, figure out some magic way of dealing with the economy, because I don't think they shifted quickly enough to assuring the American public that the economy was the top of their agenda and they had a plan. I think, you know, if you ask my dad is here with me tonight, and I asked him on the way over, you know, do you know what Obama's jobs plan is? And my dad is very politically savvy and reads the paper and follows these things, doesn't know. So he's my point of one reference. But I bet if we polled the room that it would be difficult for people to say what the jobs plan is for the Obama administration. I think that is a real difficulty.
I actually, in researching for this last week, I noticed half of all in a New York Times poll. Sorry, Dan, not a Washington Post poll. I couldn't find this in the Post poll. New York Times poll, half of all voters think that TARP was passed under Obama. Of course, it's not true. So, that's sort of an ongoing problem that you cannot over-rely on intense knowledge on the part of the voters.
I think by last spring, there was almost nothing they could do. I think that, I have rarely seen an election that was so clear so far in advance of what was likely to happen. I mean, obviously, you can't tell the exact number of House seats that are going to flip, but you could see this wave coming very early. That in for a variety of reasons, the country locked in opinions of Obama, and given what had happened in the first year, in 3 or 4 months, it was clear that the right side of the electorate was energized and the left side was demoralized. And I don't think there was, given, as Ann said, there was no more money to spend to try to do anything. They had played all that out. So they were just destined to kind of ride it out and take the shellacking and then begin to pick up the pieces.
Is there something, let me undermine my own first question here and play devil's advocate for a minute. I wonder if, in a different sense, you could look at the first 2 years of the Obama administration and see a much rosier picture. And I'm wondering if there's some validity to that. You could say, here's a guy who signaled domestic policy achievement, slowly improving economy, slowly, not much, but slowly improving economy. His popularity now, I went back and looked at Gallup polls, his popularity is now equal to Bill Clinton's popularity at the corresponding time in the first term. He's more popular than Ronald Reagan at the corresponding time in the first term, both reelected. Are we being too hard on Barack Obama? Are we expecting too much out of him?
You know, there's an interesting poll that you didn't cite, a poll question, and that is the country going in the right direction or the wrong direction? And about 6 months into the administration, that flipped. And it's now something like 64% are saying wrong direction, and it's been a large gap for a long time. I think it's hard to make the case that it may not look like it, but this is a subtly successful 2 years. No, the election sent an unmistakable message. Obamacare was repealed in the House by a much larger margin than originally had passed it in the Democratic House. It seems to me the case that that despite appearances, this has been a success so far is very hard to make. What would be Exhibit A if you were going to make that case?
I'd give a couple. I think it's actually amazing how much has changed in the last 2 years. We were on this path to trying to say that Americans should bear more responsibility and more risk-taking with regard to pensions, with regard to health care. We were having fewer people on unemployment. Students were having a hard time getting loans. The Obama administration has really shifted this. They have a very different vision of government. They haven't been able to articulate it, but we, you know, passed a major health reform that we've already talked about. But in addition to that, as I said, we passed this major change in unemployment insurance, opening it up to many more people. As part of the health bill, something you probably didn't read very much about, is that we also expanded direct lending to students so they could have more access to college. You probably know also that the Obama administration passed major consumer protections in terms of the financial industry, so in relation to the mortgage crisis, credit card crises, that we really are going to have a much more robust government role in terms of consumer protection. So it's a really quite a shift in terms of the envisioning of what the government should do to protect ordinary middle-class Americans from economic insecurity. As I say, I don't think that the American public yet know how much has changed. And the problem is that I think it's going to take some years for us to be able to look back and see that these changes did make a big impact in a positive direction. I don't know that we're going to get to that soon. But I think if we look back in 10 years from now, we're going to see that this was a pivotal time in our country.
And I think Jack, maybe you want to get in on that, but I think part of the exhibit would just be that he is in fact more popular than a couple of other recent first-term presidents who were in fact reelected, or as popular as Bill Clinton, more so than Ronald Reagan.
Well, one difficulty, and here's something political scientists don't like to admit, that models really don't work. Period. That is, we're in a period where there are a lot of variables for which we don't have good analogs. Look at the size of the national debt and the likely trend of the national debt. We're way out in the blue. We just don't have anything with which to compare that. And at least in the short run, that is leading to a reaction involving the Tea Party, the movement toward a very strict interpretation of the Constitution. We're in an economic era, extended period of very high unemployment. Don't really have good analogs to that. So how this plays out in the future, it's hard to say. More likely than not that the president will win re-election, but I wouldn't necessarily bet my next mortgage payment on that.
Dan, did you want?
I think if you look at President Obama and compare him to both President Reagan and President Clinton, compared to Clinton at this time in Clinton's presidency, he's probably in somewhat better shape in this regard. He's made a faster pivot off of the mat from the election defeat than Bill Clinton did after 94. It took Bill Clinton many months to kind of get his sea legs. And clearly, President Obama had a very successful lame duck session, which I think gave him and the White House team some greater confidence to take on the Republicans. If you compare him with Reagan, Reagan had lower numbers and higher unemployment at this point than President Obama has. The difficulty for President Obama is that Reagan was able to have a period of extraordinary economic growth beginning in the middle of 1983 and carrying through the 1984 election. I mean, quarterly growth rates of 7.5%, 8.5%, which is far beyond anything the economists are talking about now, which means the unemployment rate may go down some, but it's probably going to go down more slowly than it did during Reagan. Now, so much of this ultimately becomes public perception. Do people feel that things are going in the right direction or not? Clyde's right. People at this point don't feel that. But if the unemployment rate continues to tick down and the stock market doesn't go into the tank but perhaps continues to rise some, you know, then people may look at President Obama, particularly given the opposition, and say, we'd rather stick with him than not. I mean, as Jack suggests, it is very difficult to defeat an incumbent president in this country unless, you know, things are extraordinarily bad, and we don't know what they're going to be like in another year.
Dan, I'd be interested in your views as to whether, if Obama remains reticent on entitlements, the big driver of the deficits and the debt, is that going to harm him with the electorate, do you think? Or are we going to continue to pretending that that looming problem isn't there?
You know, there's some evidence that the public is more attuned to the longer-term problem of Social Security and somewhat more willing to do some of the, you know, some of the tough things you would have to do to fix Social Security. But still not, most people aren't there on supporting those. I think there is still probably a greater risk than a clear reward for tackling those. Both sides obviously say they're going to try to get to it this year, but I think we should all be skeptical that they're really serious about that, unless there is a kind of a collective willingness to hold hands and walk off the ledge together. And so far, neither side's shown that they're prepared to do that.
Well, let's talk about the coming year for a second, and what the president does in the coming year. So, keep his fingers crossed for economic growth of 7.5% a quarter. But other than that, what's the agenda he pursues? It seems to me the State of the Union offered a sort of ambitious but vague agenda without a lot of detail. Today he mentioned changes to No Child Left Behind, at least in the initial story I saw. Again, not a whole lot of detail. Is there what does he do for the next year in terms of a domestic agenda?
I think it's curious, actually, which is to say that his State of the Union really focused on education, and he's out there talking about No Child Left Behind, making changes and really showing how committed he is with his very strong Secretary of Education. This is an issue that people care about, but I think many people don't see the federal government as playing the large role in it. What they're seeing is what's happening here in California, which is, you know, kind of hanging on how bad are the cuts going to be from the state budget cuts, which is a much higher percentage of our education budget than what's happening at the federal level. So it's a bit removed, and it's, you know, again, not really about economic security that families are facing. So I think it's a curious move that they're making to focus as much as they have been on education.
Well, it's a bit like Clinton after
school uniforms.
Well, yeah, when there's not money to spend, you have to find things to do that don't cost a lot of money, and he has found some. He moved on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and this move on the Defense of Marriage Act. Those were free, as it were, and I suspect he'll look for other such steps to take that can appeal to some part of his coalition.
He's gotten a lot of criticism for not showing leadership in the current budget talks, but if you compare it with the Clinton administration, you kind of understand why he's hanging back. In 1995, a lot of people forget this, the government shut down when Bill Clinton vetoed legislation. He was able to win that argument because the Republicans were divided, and he was really good at selling his point of view. With President Obama, if the government shuts down, it will be because a bill never got to his desk in the first place. That makes it easier for him not to to be tainted by the blame of the government shutdown. If I were working in the White House, I'd say, hey, cool.
Do you think American people will really get that in the sense that they're already kind of pointing fingers at him and worried that he's not leading. Do you think that they'll blame him?
Well, I think at that point you're going to see a concerted effort to blame the Republicans. And if it's anything like 1995, 96, some of the Republicans will be saying, hey, let's shut down the government. That's a good thing. and they'll be kind of off message. And I think that's what they're counting on.
What struck me about the State of the Union was that rhetorically it sounded quite ambitious. Mm-hmm. But that most of what he was talking about, I think, was well out into the future.
Yeah.
At a time when unemployment rate's at 9% and there are, you know, lots of immediate problems that people are feeling, that the call to action was not a call to action to kind of get the economy off the mat right now. It was to put money into things that over time will keep the economy in good shape once it's in good shape. And I think that has been, I mean, I think he genuinely believes that that's an important thing to do, and one of the aspects of President Obama's leadership style is this kind of patience and willingness to take a much longer view. But as a politician, that is a risky proposition, and particularly in a time when people are as unhappy as they have been about the state of things.
What happened with government reorganization?
I don't think that's a big... I know Al Gore got some mileage out of it.
No, the president mentioned that in the State of the Union. It was but I haven't heard of it since.
I don't think there's a lot of substance to it. I don't think there's a great deal of commitment to it. But if you are coming off an election in which people have expressed dissatisfaction with the size and scope of government, if you suggest that you're going to try to do something about the way government is put together and make it more streamlined and more efficient, you're trying to gain some political mileage out of that. But I don't think there's much there.
I did a search, and the first president to play that card was James Madison. Serious.
I think Claudia is right, though. I mean, this is about ideas that aren't going to cost a lot of money, right? And so, you know, whether it's education and reorganizing the deck chairs or a massive reorganization of the government, I think that's a really good point.
And that is presumably why he talked in the State of the Union about things that are far off into the future. I mean, by 2035, 80% of energy from clean energy, things like that. Those are free for now, right? You don't have to actually do anything that costs anything if it's a 25-year goal.
Well, they would argue that modest investments at this point pay a big dividend down the line, and that if you wait to do it, it's going to be more costly, and it will take much longer to do it. So, that's a argument that they can probably legitimately make, but it is asking people to wait a long time for some of these things to come about. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about President Obama, I mean, if you think about him in comparison to Ronald Reagan and recall that in the campaign, partly I think to get under Bill Clinton's skin, he talked about Reagan as a transformative president, as he said, unlike Richard Nixon or Bill Clinton. but if you think about Ronald Reagan after 2 years in office, you knew what Ronald Reagan was about and what he stood for. Cutting taxes, trying to shrink the power of the federal government, if not the actual size of the federal government, push power out of Washington, and confront the Soviet Union. As you said, if you were asking people to define what are the kind of core convictions of President Obama, I think it's much harder. When he's accused of being a big government liberal, he says, "No, I'm not a big government liberal." And when he's accused or praised for moving to the center after the election, he said, "I haven't moved to the center." So the question is, well, where does he think he is, and how does he define that? Well, how does he define his perception of government and the role of government, and his approach to the world, other than kind of more multilateralism? So I think this question of the definition of Barack Obama remains something of a mystery 2 years into his presidency.
And do you think that's a mystery because of, and I'd be curious what everybody thinks about it, because of his failure to communicate that? Is he just a He's clearly a smart guy who may have very complex beliefs that are difficult to define in a very short stanza. Why is there the difficulty to define him? Is it just, again, a failure of PR, or is
no,
it that he's hard to define?
I don't think it's a failure of PR. I always thought that during the campaign there was a kind of a contradiction in the message, which is to say, part of what attracted people to Barack Obama as a candidate was this this sense of a post-partisan politics. And that brought people from across the political spectrum. He offered the promise of moving beyond these long, difficult debates that we've been having since Vietnam on one issue or another, whether it's foreign policy or culture wars or role of government. He suggested that he had a way or would lead the country to a better place in dealing with those. At the same time, his agenda, particularly his domestic agenda, was a pretty liberal big government agenda. He wouldn't have described it that way, but the kind of health care plan he was talking about, even without an individual mandate, was a big comprehensive health care plan. And he clearly believes in an activist role for government. In a campaign, you never have to square that circle. I mean, in a campaign, your goal is to find a set of messages that appeal broadly enough that you can get a coalition to win the election. When you come into office, I think those two messages in particular created a real clash. And it was I think, exacerbated by the fact that the country, instantly repolarized, or probably was more polarized at the time of his election than any of us were smart enough to recognize. Some people were, who I've talked to since, who said you weren't looking at the data very closely. But so I think that once he got into office, that kind of fell apart, and so it's been hard for him to reassemble that in a coherent way for people to grasp onto. And it's why there's disappointment on the left and disappointment on the and not dis- disappointment deep dislike on the right.
Fury.
Yeah.
No, it was a very polarizing decade when you think about it. It started with the tie of 2000, which ended up with Bush getting the presidency and Gore having a few more popular votes. And then, of course, there was 9/11, which brought the country together in a unique way in my lifetime. But then it quickly fell apart with the extremely divisive Iraq venture. Of course, a lot more people were for it at the time than a few months afterwards. Of course, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden were among those who supported it. But certainly, by the time Bush's second term was over, the country had a great desire for a change. And Barack Obama, in addition to being the Democrat, the alternative, the non-Bush, had this very attractive sort of grace about him, sort of bodily grace, fluency, eloquence, it seemed. And I think there was a deep desire in many people to see him as a racial healer. The single sentence that probably had the most impact in his political career was that we're not the red states or the blue states, we're the United States, in that speech at the Democratic Convention that brought him to national attention. And I think part of the disappointment with him comes from the fact that it's a return to that polarization that for a moment we thought we were going to get away from at the time of his election.
Jack, I'm curious if you, political scientists sometimes are known to say that it's the elites who are polarized, not as much the voters. I'm curious, do you agree with this increasing polarization idea?
You haven't had a real shift that much to the left or the right in the electorate. What you have is a sorting out. Even during the Reagan years, you had a fairly substantial number of moderate to conservative Democrats in the electorate, and even still some relatively liberal Republicans in the electorate. And that is pretty much ended. Most people are where they're supposed to be now. If you're a conservative, you're probably a Republican. If you're a liberal, you're a Democrat. And I think we see here in California that playing out in primaries.
I'm going to go back to the agenda for the president over the next year, whatever it is. I guess it's No Child Left Behind, whatever else he can figure out that's free. Is there, and Jack, I'll ask you, since you worked for congressional Republicans, is there any, or I'll ask you first and then everybody else jump in, is there an incentive for congressional Republicans to play along, work with him, whatever phrase you want to use, to actually do anything, or is there an incentive to not do anything?
There's an incentive to cooperate with the president on certain issues. On some issues of trade and foreign policy, the president may find more support among the Republicans than among Democrats. And part of that is just a matter of ideology. Again, drawing a comparison to the 1990s, there came a point where Republicans saw that it was in their interest to collaborate with Bill Clinton on things such as welfare reform. I don't know if we're at that point yet, but if we're on a similar trajectory, that could happen.
Dan, do you want to get in? Or Dan, I'm curious if you think the Republicans will, their role will be.
Yeah, I just was going to say one example, which is I do think 96 in the Clinton term is a really interesting time where the Republicans were able to work with a president who really wanted to, you know, win a second term. And so not only did he get welfare reform, you get immigration, immigration reform. You also get some of the criminal defense issues that people find really challenging. So there's a lot of kind of moving to the right for that president. I think similarly this year, you are going to see some feedback from this president. So already just in the last week, we saw this issue of the healthcare waivers. Now, many people might not understand what this is, but let me just say a few words about it. What has happened is after the Affordable Care Act passed, as we know, there's been these litigation in courts challenging the individual mandate. That's still bubbling up through the court system. But many people say the state should have a lot more flexibility to decide how to actually make health reform work. And so the president has stepped back a little bit from his health reform bill and said, okay, if you're challenging and you think you have a better idea, then I'm going to say I'll support a bill in Congress to allow states to do something different in 2014 rather than waiting to 2017, or 2019, which was what was in the original bill. So I think that you may see more of this responsiveness to Republican ideas in a way that you might not in a different year.
I think we are in a period of, and I can't tell you how many months, of testing one side against the other. And I think there's probably a desire on the part of the White House to work some deals with the Republicans. And I think on some of the leadership of the Republican Party, they don't want to make the mistake that they feel was made after 1994 in kind of charging ahead too fast. I think a couple of things will come into play. One is John Boehner's not fully in charge of the House. I mean, he's got a Tea Party group of freshmen who are rebellious and rambunctious, and he's not going to be able to simply tell them this is what we are going to do. I mean, the grassroots of the Republican Party is in rebellion against Washington, and they expect the Republican Party today to act differently than the Republicans acted when they last held power in Congress. And so that complicates things. I think for the time being, we're in a kabuki dance over spending cuts. And at some point, one side or the other will conclude that their position is creating political problems for them, and they will be the first to move. And I don't know whether that's going to be the White House or the Republicans in Congress. But ultimately, if there are these clashes, we're in a week when the current continuing resolution runs out. There will have to be probably another short-term resolution passed. Then there will have to be a deal to get us through the rest of this fiscal year, and then they turn to a much bigger problem, which is the next year's budget, and then they've still got entitlements to deal with. I mean, there are a whole series of tests that are coming over the months. And I think both sides came in with the idea that, you know, that they were going to try to hold the line as long as they could on their position. And public opinion will begin to dictate. After the election, I did a piece about President Obama, should he be Bill Clinton or Harry Truman, which is to say, should he do what Clinton did, which was to triangulate, or do what Harry Truman did, which was really kind of take on the Congress and run against them in 1948. After I wrote that piece, the son of James Rowe, who was an advisor to Truman, sent me an email, and he said, have you ever read the memo that my father wrote to Truman in 1940, after the 1946 election? I said, no, I'd never heard of it. I knew that his father had been involved in the famous Clark Clifford memo about how to get reelected in 1948. But he wrote a memo, and he said, and it was a very dense and detailed and smart memo, but he said the single power that the president has is the power of the bully pulpit and the power of public opinion. And it is inevitable that a president with an opposition Congress is going to be in a series of confrontations and clashes. And the key for the president is to lead the country only as fast as the country is prepared to go along. And I thought, boy, that was so smart and wise. And Truman obviously adopted that with the idea of keeping the country with him while going after the Congress. I don't quite know how the president is going to do that, but they are clearly attuned to different parts of the electorate as they begin to figure out how to do these battles.
He's been sort of oddly unsuccessful at using the bully pulpit, though, hasn't he? Again, for a guy whose campaign was so rhetorically inspiring.
Few rhetorical high points that stand out. I think we'd probably all agree that the Tucson speech was very successful. I also admired the Nobel Prize acceptance, which was really the only time I have heard Barack Obama convincingly formulate a positive view of the role of the United States in the world in the last 50 years. And he did it effectively there. I don't know who wrote the speech, and I don't know if it was really his personal sentiment, but he said it very effectively. I still think it's not essentially a bully pulpit problem. This giant fact of the fiscal situation, you know, we borrow 40 cents on every dollar, and we print money. And this leads someplace very bad. And the Republicans who were so mobilized last November gave high priority to this issue, and President Obama has not given it high priority. He discussed it a little bit in his State of the Union address as something that sometime in the future is going to need to be addressed. But he still shows no sign of willingness to address it. And that's the issue I'm following, that I'm curious to see what becomes of that in the coming year. I think it will be a terrible failure of leadership if the Obama position seems to be trillion-dollar-plus deficits, as far as the eye can see, are fine, are not a problem.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting, in the State of the Union, he did make a pretty serious commitment that there was going to be no increases in domestic discretionary spending other than education. And so I think he is trying to send a message that this is something he cares about. You know, I still contend that he's not getting through, that people aren't hearing that. So, you know, maybe that's not enough for people. Maybe what you're saying is that's not enough, and that they're worried about these other looming bills to come down the road in terms of health reform and others.
There are a couple of questions. Maybe we'll finish with these. There are a couple of questions about sort of who Obama is, I guess, and maybe this goes back to Dan's point about that it's hard to define Obama. But one is, compared to Reagan and Clinton, doesn't Obama fail to have a visceral connection to middle America, and if so, why?
Because he's not middle America. He's, you know, he's Harvard Law, and University of Chicago and community organizing and
Hyde Park. But let me play devil's advocate. I mean, George Bush was Harvard Law and Harvard Business School and Kenna Bunkport, but nobody said he failed to connect with middle America.
True, but he...
affected a Texas accent.
No, he had a Texas accent. He was from Texas. It was his father who moved to Texas. He connects better with ordinary people, whereas Barack Obama always, after his community organizing days, always moved in elite circles.
Jack?
I think Barack Obama would be a wonderful dean of faculty. as you said, the contemplative qualities have both benefits and costs. We want presidents to be deliberative, but there also comes a time when you have to put the hammer down.
I want to read something from the interview that we did with Obama in 2008 when we asked him about Lincoln and governing style, because it bears on this point of kind of how he sees himself and in some ways the kind of the deliberativeness of his approach. He talked about how Lincoln's his favorite president for a lot of reasons, but he said one of the things he admired most in Lincoln was that there was a, quote, deep-rooted honesty and empathy to the man that allowed him to always be able to see the other person's point of view and always sought to find the truth is in the gap between you and me. The truth is out there somewhere. He said, I don't fully possess it, you don't fully possess it, and it's our job to listen and learn and imagine enough to be able to get to that truth. He said, if you look at Lincoln's presidency, he never lost that. Most of our other great presidents, there was the sense of working the angles and bending other people to their will. He said, FDR being the classic example. Lincoln just found a way to shape public opinion and shape people around him and lead them and guide them without tricking them or bullying them, but just through the force of what I've talked about, the way of helping to illuminate the truth. He said, I find that a very compelling style of leadership. It's not one that I've mastered, but I think that's when leadership is at its best. And I think if you think about the way Obama has approached things, that is revelatory in understanding why he sometimes operates the way he does.
Okay, on that thoughtful note, and I think Abe Lincoln trumps James Madison, maybe. I'm not sure. But anyway, on that thoughtful note, I think we'll stop. We'll come back next year. My thanks to the panel, Claudia Anderson, Jack Pitney, Anne O'Leary, Dan Balk. Thank you. Good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.